I call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this February 22nd. I apologize to those of you that have come away. We'll have a slightly truncated agenda today. Interesting debate that you may have listened to on the floor ran over a considerable time. I expect to have a quorum here shortly, but in the meantime, let me start by announcing House Bill 2621, scheduled for a work session today, will be carried over to Monday. We don't have the paperwork to deal with it. We're going to work the other two bills and expect to pass them today. But 2691 is carried over to Monday. Is that right? Yeah, it is carried over to Monday. Let's open an informational meeting on the coordinated care metrics or matrices or something. And I expect Dr. Goldberg and his able wing person to tell us which three of them you finally picked to be the ones that everybody will help be responsible for. Or I understand there's a rumor that you have each of them draw three of them out of a bowl that they'll be responsible for. So anyway, we can deal with it. Thank you guys for coming.
Glad to be here. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. Dr. Greenlick and I have had a long-standing discussion about the appropriate number of metrics, and we've landed somewhere between 3 and 33. What I thought I'd do is there's been a lot of discussion about the coordinated care organizations and what they're going to be held accountable for on by way of quality outcomes and improving health. And so we're here today to just walk you through what that plan is, what the agreement is with CMS. And it really is our accountability plan. As a committee may know, we've entered into an agreement with the federal government that allows us to set up these new coordinated care organizations. We've committed to lowering the cost of care by 2 percentage points in growth. And they've given us $1.9 billion over 5 years to help us do that. And I think because of that, they've been really engaged in being certain that we can demonstrate and are accountable to what we said we would do. And we've been working with the feds very diligently on a well over 100-page plan that spells out what the state's accountability is. We finalized that on December 18th of the previous year. As I had indicated, you know, our commitment to the feds has been to reduce the growth of the cost of care by 2 percentage points, to ensure that quality of care improves, to ensure that the health of the Medicaid population improves, to establish a 1% withhold for timely data, and to establish a quality pool so that we begin to move away from simply paying for individual procedures and starting to pay for performance and quality, and that's what we're here to talk to you about. You know, the purpose of our quality strategy is to really address those special terms and conditions in the waiver. And there are a couple of elements in our quality strategy. One is very traditional. The traditional piece of our quality strategy is something that the feds ask all states to do. It's about on-site reviews to be certain that care is being delivered and it's appropriate. It's about quarterly and annual financial reporting, complaints and grievances, fraud and abuse. All those kinds of things remain unchanged. What does begin to change is the way we look at quality improvement. We're going to implement performance improvement projects for the CCOs. They have to have, you've heard me talk to you about the transformation plans, plans that will demonstrate how they will begin to change how care is delivered to meet these goals. There'll be increased transparency, and what we're here today to talk about is the financial metrics. The last comment I'd make before we get into the metrics is we're also providing some support for this.
You said financial metrics. You don't mean
only. I'm sorry. Thank you. The outcome metrics, not the, we know what the financial metrics are. Mm-hmm. Lower the cost of care by 2%. We provide some support for CCOs. We're setting up this transformation center. You may have heard yesterday that we've got some increased federal support to do that, which is really wonderful and will really help us meet these goals. We'll be setting up learning collaboratives so these CCOs can learn from each other. They'll have some peer-to-peer and rapid cycle learning. There'll be some investment in community advisory councils, and there'll be some support for non-traditional health workers and primary care practices so we can meet these goals. So we've got these goals, and let me turn things over to Tina Edlin, who's been the person really driving this with the feds and most knowledgeable to really talk through what these metrics are, why we came to them. And so let me turn it over to Tina.
Sure, thanks.
Just before we go on, a question to put on the garage or whatever we do, not to answer right now. This issue of the peer-to-peer, we're hearing that the CCOs can't possibly hold any meetings in public because they'll give away trade secrets to their competitors. How is that going to work? If they have that attitude that what they do is all about trade secrets that they can't give away in a public meeting, how will they be able to do that? But don't answer that now. Just put it on the...
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Tina Edlin. I'm the Chief of Policy for the Oregon Health Authority. So as Bruce said, I spent several months with CMS talking about the metrics by which not only the CCOs would be held accountable, but the metrics that the state would be held accountable. They thought both levels of accountability were really critical. What they were really concerned with was that we didn't achieve our 2 percentage point cost reduction in Medicaid trend at the expense of quality and access. So this became a really important piece of the accountability for them. This first slide talks about the 33 metrics that the state will be held accountable to. They fall into 7 different quality focus areas that were identified in collaboration with us, with OHA and CMS, looking at the history of the Oregon Health Plan, looking at some of our data, our previous data, and identifying areas that they want to direction that CMS wants to go in nationally. So that's really what led to the creation of these 7 focus areas. So we worked on developing a set of metrics that not only had national standards by which we could follow, but also fell into these 7 focus areas.
You, if you haven't already sent this around to us electronically to the committee.
Oh, yeah, no, I think we did, but yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
We'll make sure you get it if we didn't. So the 33 metrics are the metrics that the state is held accountable to. As I said, there are significant financial penalties for not achieving goals in those metrics, improvement or benchmark goals. It's 5% of the total funding that they gave us that is at risk if we don't achieve those metrics. There's a subset of those metrics. There's 17 metrics that the CCOs are held accountable for and for which there are financial incentives for them to also reach improvement goals. Those metrics came from a committee that was created by the legislature, but statutorily created to determine what metrics CCOs would be held accountable to. And that committee has 9 members, 3 members at large, 3 with expertise in health outcomes measures, and 3 representatives from CCOs. So they used a public process. We worked really hard. Actually, the committee met quite quite often in a short period of time in order to identify and recommend the 17 metrics that they passed forward to CMS. CMS actually, it was a pretty powerful tool with CMS to see that something had gone through such a rigorous public process of identification. They only changed three very small things in the set of metrics. They wanted us to remove one. We had very similar adult mental health measures, and they wanted us to replace one of those with a child mental health measures is an example of what they changed. So that subset of 17 is really the group that came from our metrics and scoring committee. The data collection strategy became a really important piece of this. We didn't want to add burden to the CCOs who are already working pretty hard trying to get started and actually deliver health care to their population. So we really focused on trying to identify metrics at the front end that come from administrative data. We all know that there's weaknesses to that. Their billing data isn't the best representation of health outcomes, but it's readily available, it's easy to get, and it gives us a place to start that we could all agree on. There are some of the measures that require either chart review or electronic health records, and the OHA has agreed that we will take responsibility for those as well, especially at this beginning of trying to establish a measurement system. So, and then there's a few measures that come from surveys, which OHA will also administer. So we really are focused on keeping that burden to a minimum. These 17 measures, as I said, they have financial incentives associated with them. It's a quality pool that was part of the requirement of our waiver with CMS. The quality pool is really seen as a bridge strategy, so we can move from a purely capitated model within the global budget to one that's made up of capitation and a quality reward for good outcomes. So in the beginning, this quality pool is set at 2% of the total PMPM, the total global budget that goes to the CCOs, and if they meet benchmarks or improvement goals in every one of the 17 metrics, then they can get a total amount that's available to them that's equivalent to 2% of that budget.
So we're beginning to move more and more of the capitation payment to quality and performance rather than simply paying for procedures.
Right. And part of the agreement, as one of the bullet points pointed out, that 2% is to increase every year of the demonstration. So the last 4 years of the demonstration, that will increase and become a bigger part of the budget. So I won't read all of these. This is really lays out the 17 metrics into the seven focus areas. There's five metrics that address issues around behavioral health. It's a big driver of healthcare costs in the Oregon Health Plan, so we wanted to make sure we had an adequate number of metrics that address behavioral health. There are four metrics that deal with...
Before you...
Uh-huh.
Do they start with an objective? Do they start with a baseline? Do they have improvement? How are these used?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, yes, we have. We established one of the agreements we made in the Metrics and Scoring Committee is that 2011 would, for the whatever the predecessor organization was in the area, would be the baseline for this measurement system. I can actually send you, and it's in the accountability plan, the details about how the quality pool will work, and they can either qualify by meeting an improvement goal, improving from where they are, or actually meeting the benchmark. The benchmark is established usually at 90% of what the national Medicaid number is.
Well, could you pick any one of these and give an example of how it worked, like the second one, for example?
So the screening, brief intervention,
or any other
for
one.
Treatment, or any of them. So I'll follow-up care for children on ADHD medication. There's that data is collected by most Medicaid programs in the country, so that data is available to us. We can look at what the 90th percentile is, a goal would be to achieve for providing follow-up care to children who've been prescribed ADHD medication, then what we'll do is we look at what that number was in 2011 before any of the CCOs were implemented, before the intervention started, and what they will, if say they were at 20% and the 90th percentile was 60%. So there's a formula actually that's applied for what kind of an improvement goal they would have to achieve to qualify for the quality pool. And then there's that benchmark, the 90th percentile. So if they got to their 60%, if they were at 60% right out of the gate, they would, on that metric, they would qualify for the quality pool. Is there any other question? Nothing. Okay, so there's four maternal and child health metrics. There are three, as we, you know, point out pretty often, there's about 80% of the costs are driven by 20% of the people with multiple chronic conditions, so it was important to have some measures of care for people with chronic conditions. These were the three that were chosen by the committee. Again, you know, you could go, there's a lot of choices here, but we really felt, the committee really felt that these three give us a range of the chronic conditions that occur within our population. And then access obviously is a really important piece of what we want to maintain access, especially with 2014 coming up and about 240,000 people potentially being added to the Oregon Health Plan. CMS wanted to ensure that we have a fairly robust set of access measures. So these three items get to that. This first one actually is one of the ones that CMS changed somewhat. We originally had suggested just a reduction in emergency department use. They wanted to make sure that they saw increases in ambulatory care at the same time we were reducing emergency department use. Then the last two, the patient experience of care, it's really a critically important piece of quality. We know there's strong evidence that people who are more satisfied with their care are more engaged in their care, and you get better outcomes. So that becomes really an important piece of this. And then electronic health records. CMS has invested a lot of money in states to increase the access to electronic health records. They want to see states pushing toward a better use of electronic health records. So one of the measures is looking at our statewide adoption of electronic health records. So the quality pool and how it will work, again, it's 2% of the total global budget. It is to be distributed completely every year, no carryover dollars. So there's a pretty complicated formula for how you qualify for the quality pool. But there's two rounds. There's the first round of distribution based on how your CCO does on these 17 metrics. There's a second round. Rather than weight any individual metric, the committee didn't feel like it wanted to spend a lot of time thinking about which, how they would weight the individual metrics. There's a second round because there will be people who don't qualify on some of their metrics, so not all of the dollars will be distributed in the first round. In the second round, the challenge pool, the committee selected four metrics that they thought were really critically important to transformation. So it's the adoption of patient-centered primary care homes, screening for depression, the alcohol and drug misuse screening and intervention, and optimal diabetes care. So that second round, a CCO can qualify for additional, the dollars that are left in the pool after the first round, through by doing really well on those four metrics. So it's
only one more than three.
It's
thank you.
We tried. So then the last slide here is second to last slide. Is to talk a little bit, some of the confusion about the number of metrics is that there are, through an agreement we have with the US DOJ for about the access to community mental health services in the state and the community mental health system in the state, we agreed to engage in a data collection system so that we could really see, try to be evidence-based and numbers-based and see how we are doing in community mental health and services. So the USDOJ settled on 111 metrics. That is a few more than three, but we have identified again. Really? We feel very strongly that these are the responsibility of the agency and not the responsibility of CCOs. It was our agreement with USDOJ. So we've worked pretty hard, looked very closely to identify methods for collecting these data items within the agency. There are only 10. We're collecting 101 of the 111. There are 10 that we really can't get from any other place than the CCO. It's for instance, their crisis services call lines for crisis services. We don't know how many vendors they have. USDOJ has asked for the number of subcontractors, where the subcontractors are, and how many people they serve in a year. And so that will have to come from from the CCO. Excuse me.
Just to give you a sense of the agreement, because I think when one looks at the difference between 17 and 33 and 111, the agreement with the Department of Justice isn't about setting up financial metrics or quality pools. I mean, much of those metrics is really information about how our community mental health system is functioning, mm-hmm. that quite frankly we should have as part of assuring that the investments we make in our community mental health systems are going to where they need to go. So I think it's a different, although we put together the metrics for the Department of Justice along with these other metrics, it's a very different set of metrics, and we're very comfortable with this as information that, quite frankly, we think should be available. And that was part of the discussion with the Department of Justice. And much as we did with the CCOs in this agreement, the first year is a baseline year to see mm-hmm. where we are. Mm-hmm. We're done.
Great. Questions? Yes, Representative Thompson.
I understand what you're trying to do here, and it's impressive, but I'm a very simple, practical person, as you know. You don't have to comment on that. We're facing a situation where we have a significant population of homeless people in this state who are mentally ill and or drug addicted. In addition to that, we have a significant population of people in this state who are drug and alcohol abusers. Now, we agreed when we went into this, we're going to take those people and throw them right in the middle of primary health care. How are we going to do that while we decrease overall medical costs by 2%? I mean, is there any thought on that?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee, we know that quite frankly, untreated mental health and addiction is a driver of healthcare costs. So clearly, and it speaks to these metrics, being certain that individuals who have gone either undiagnosed or untreated get treatment, that's actually a strategy to help lower costs. We also know that individuals with chronic illness who have mental health problems have much higher costs as well. So many of our CCOs are really using a strategy of ensuring that people with mental health problems get optimal mental health care is indeed a strategy to help reduce those. I think the other way that we as a state will have some benefit is in 2014, many of the individuals that you're referring to who are homeless and have serious mental health problems. Many of them don't have health care coverage, and they rely on our county-based systems. And beginning in 2014, should we as a state choose to expand Medicaid, those individuals will now have coverage. It will be easier to get them services. So I think we have a pathway here to, one, improve people's lives, and number two, to help address some of the cost issues by really getting at exactly what you're talking about, really putting resources towards mental health and addiction treatment.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
The companion question, and it's
and
a startup. And
Kenny Geyer after that.
It's a startup question. It seems to me if we're really going to move the dime on cost, we need to get all of the Medicaid population into a primary care physician's office or other box, do a baseline screening, and establish a glide path for health improvement. Yet we're facing enormous access issues.
Can I intervene? Let's hold this discussion today, specifically the metrics which they're talking about.
Well, I think this drives the metrics, though, because...
We've got about 5 minutes more
okay.
to deal with it. Yes, it's how you change it, but
yeah.
Let's just talk about what's being measured.
Okay, fine.
And
I'll be quick in a response, which is many of our CCOs are tackling that head on, and in one of our CCOs, that's a clear goal of theirs, and they already have close to 80% of their members getting care in a patient-centered primary care home. So I think we're moving in the right direction.
That's the kind of measurement I want to see.
Yeah.
Who are we taking care of?
Those are the kind of outcomes we need to get. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm delighted to see as one of the metrics that is included in the incentives, the depression screening, because I remember seeing some statistic about something like 70% of people who take their own lives have seen a primary care practitioner within 30 days. Mm-hmm. And so the more that we can link with very specific tools that you're incentivizing is great. My question is about tobacco. The proposal is to put a lot of the tobacco master settlement dollars into our OHP and CCO program, and I know that's part of the quality metrics that you're measuring, but not on the list of incentives. So I wonder if you can address why that might be and how fluid this might be, and are there opportunities to change which ones you're incentivizing financially?
Happy to. Chair Greenlit, Representative Kenny Geyer. In the 33 metrics that the state is responsible for as a whole, you'll see those kind of metrics, tobacco use, obesity, things that are more difficult to hold an individual CCO accountable to. There was also some issues around parsimony, is how many are we going to hold the CCOs accountable to, and what will we hold the state accountable for. So you'll see those in that larger set. I don't have those
here.
I think it was in... Pardon?
Will we get those other 16?
Yeah, I actually think that was in the materials we sent to, but we'll make sure that they are. There's a table that shows
the 33 along and the 17 that are a part of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there's no financial incentive, as I understand, with the tobacco, and you know, it being the biggest preventable cause of death and disease.
And there's a financial risk for the state if we don't achieve improvement in reduction of tobacco use, attached to the funding that the federal government gave us. So
I'm curious about why it's not included, but also how fluid is it that you could change what it is you're incentivizing?
Yes. What the committee has set up is an annual review of these metrics, and they have the ability. We do need to go back to CMS on the items that the CCOs are accountable for, but the agreement has really made it clear that there's an expectation, though, actually, that we look at these metrics every year to identify, number one, which ones really aren't driving us in the direction that we want to go in, which we expect to learn as we go forward. Which ones do we really need to add that are in that larger set, and we really want to now make sure that the CCOs, we're not getting the kind of progress we want, and we want to add some incentive there. So the Metrics and Scoring Committee will do an annual review for what can be added and what can be taken away and what stays the same.
Can we take a round two of this topic? It would be useful if we have a chance to look over the report, and perhaps we can schedule another session where we can spend a little time on this. Mm-hmm.
You'd be happy to.
Yeah.
That'd be really useful, I think. So I urge you all to dig out that report and take a look at it. Last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, I heard you mention something that startled me a little bit, and because we have declining matching funds with the goal that we're supposed to be achieving, and I heard you say if we didn't meet some of these, that is that an additional 5% that we're going to lose on top of the regular decline in the funds coming?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, there is that 5% penalty is not for the entire Medicaid program, first of all. It's only for funding that they gave us as part of this waiver. It's also only for the duration of the waiver, so it's the next 4 years. It doesn't go on in perpetuity. It's just
5% of that declining piece. Not on top of it.
It's 5% of the declining piece. That's right.
So it wouldn't decline as fast.
It would decline faster.
We don't achieve these goals.
Mm-hmm. So rather than 90%, we'd be at 85.
Yeah, they gave us $1.9 billion.
Yeah.
And if we don't achieve these metrics in 1 year, we could be subject to up to 5% of the proportion of those dollars we were getting.
We chose how to divide up that $1.9 million. It was our choice to spend more of it at the head end and less of it as we.
But it's not the overall Medicaid program.
Right.
It's just those dollars that they've given us to do this.
That's right.
Guys, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I'm sorry we ran into this truncated time problem
our
today.
Yeah.
But I think it'll be really great to come back and we can spend perhaps as much as an hour talking about these metrics and how they're applying and the actual numbers.
Great to have maybe some of the members of the metrics committee here, too.
That would be very useful. I'll close the informational meeting on the CCO metrics, and I will open up my intention. In case you weren't here, we're carrying over 2691 because we didn't have the paperwork, but we do have the paperwork to deal with 2622 and 2081. So I will open up a work session on House Bill 2622. Mr. Administrator, will you remind us what this is about, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2622 changes the definition of physician to include podiatrists for the purpose of subjecting podiatrists to statutes regulating physicians. It changes the definition of retired physician to include retired podiatrists for the purpose of volunteer service and training. It changes the definition of physician to include podiatrists for purposes related to patient and physician privilege. It requires medical services contract to protect the advocacy of podiatrists.
I've heard of no opposition to that. Is that right, Mr. Merrill? No opposition, and we have an amendment that straightens out some of the wording problems. And Mr. Vice Chair, can I have a couple of motions from you?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments to 2622 dated 2/19/13.
Representative Thompson moves to include the -1 amendments to House Bill 2691. The -1 amendments dated
2622.
I'm sorry, 2622, I got it. Okay, I'm in the right place. 2622, dated 2/19/13. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2622 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2622 to the floor with the -1 amendments with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Sorry?
Can we put it on the consent calendar?
That would be my intention.
Bill, I don't really want to have to carry it, so if you don't mind.
I'll carry it for you, Representative Quinn.
I'd like to see it. We could.
Okay.
No, I just.
We might put the foot someplace else.
All right. Yes. That doesn't need to be part of the original motion. I think we can do that.
After.
So if you will do a roll call, please.
Representative Quinn?
Yeah, I.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenwood?
Aye. Motion carries, and if there's no objection, it will go on the consent calendar. Hearing none on the consent calendar. I close the work session on House Bill 2622 and open up a work session on House Bill 2081. Would you tell us about this one, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2081 modifies exemptions to prohibitions against the practice of psychology, a representation as psychologist without a license. It limits the graduate student exemption to students seeking academic credit as part of an organized and supervised training program. We've also received the -1 amendments, which deletes the word professional from the description of the graduate degree program.
A couple of motions.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the -1 amendments to 2081, dated 2/15/13.
Representative Thompson moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2081, dated 2/15/13. Those amendments are to make sure whether the training for psychologists was in the Psych D program or a PhD program. This applies to it. Takes away that confusion.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. I am a retired psychologist, and my son and daughter-in-law are active psychologists. We should be part of a group, but I just thought I would say that.
Good. Yeah, that's a pretty large group for you, especially.
Better insurance than not. Thank you.
I think it's not necessary to require a conflict of interest in that
like
case.
I'd like to point it out.
Is there any objection on the motion to amend? -1s are a part of House Bill 2081.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2081 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2081 as amended with the -1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Whiteley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. Dr. Kinnemer, will you carry this?
Either me or consent. What do you think?
I think this
probably
would be...
Probably it's I think, enough I should do it.
Yeah, okay, I think this would be
thank
one
you.
I should... Representative Kinnemer will carry House Bill 2081. Close the work session on House Bill 2081 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2279. Mr. Administrator, will you tell us about that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2279 allows employees of local governments to participate in benefit plans provided by the Public Employees Benefit Board and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board and defines local government.
We have several people signed up. Has everybody signed up that wants to be signed up? One more. Mr. Allen, will you kick it off? Then we'll have, well, we'll probably bring up a couple more.
That's good.
With you. Let's bring up... Joe Bessler?
Bessler?
Is he coming with you?
Sure.
Joe and Arthur, you want to join this? I do want to point out, we have an amendment coming. Is that right on this one? There was the confusion that this was a mandatory bill for all special districts and other organizations. It is clear that was not at all intended, and there's an amendment coming. I think it's not ready yet, but it's coming that will make sure it is understood this is voluntary on the part of other state governments, not mandatory. Mr. Allen?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Ken Allen. I'm the director of Oregon APSME. We represent about 24,000 members around the state and about 80 local governments scattered all over the state, large ones and small ones. For many years, we've seen the benefits of the larger employee pools in terms of the ability to hold costs down and keep the cost curve more moderate and continue to have better benefits. Especially the smaller rural local governments around the state are in trouble when it comes to their insurance plans and what they're able to offer their employees. Especially the smaller ones with, you know, 50 or 100 total employees, they see their rates increase, you know, 15%, 20%, 25% at a time. And their ability to pay those rates creates a lot of problems. And the number one problem in local government negotiations for many, many years around the state has been how to deal with health care costs. And we end up, you know, having a lot of conflict. This, for many years, we thought about creating a local government health care trust just for all local governments. But I think this bill is a better option. This bill puts in the toolbox of local governments the ability to look at the PEB option or the OEB option and voluntarily decide whether to go into those plans, be in a much larger pool that is in a better position to negotiate better rates with the insurance companies. At the end of the day, all that would be left for the employees and the unions and the employers to negotiate over is the amount of the contribution. And certainly the OEB, where it has seven or eight different plan designs and different costs, is a broader option for local governments to look at than the PEB one is. But there are some local governments that want to go into the PEB. Both PEB and OEB are doing a good job at looking at you know, transforming healthcare, holding healthcare costs down. What can we do in the areas of both wellness and effective prevention to try to hold costs down and bend that cost curve in a big way? And it would be a lot better for our local government jurisdictions to have this as an option in their toolbox. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. I've been negotiating local government collective bargaining agreements in this state for about 25 years, so I've got a lot of experience.
Joe, you going to contradict your boss?
Representative Greenlink, no. I just wanted to quickly talk about some of the conceptual amendments that we put in. I gave you we submitted a quick list, but I just wanted to go over them real quick, just so you had a sense of what we were actually shooting
who
for.
Who are you, fella?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Joe Basler, political director for Oregon. Ask me. I'm sorry. I screwed up.
Thank you.
The most important one, I think, is we want to make sure this is an option. It's not a mandate. There was some of the language of the original bill made it very much sound like a mandate. It was not our intention. We definitely want this to be something that is a choice. Secondly, special districts were not included when it came to joining OEB, and we want to make sure they had that option. It wasn't just cities and counties. The bill also it's cities, counties, and special districts. When we say local governments, that's what we're shooting for. We wanted to also, if a city or county or local government, after they have joined PEB or OEB, wanted out, they could opt out to the exchange. This is already exists for OEB, but this would move it also for PEB, just for these groups. We also wanted to make sure that as groups join these two boards, that there would be some level of representation on the boards. Right now, the boards are how their boards are established or set up in statute. And the solution we came up with was as soon as a local government wants to join PEB or OEB, that you would add two seats to those boards, one being a management level, one management represented seat, one being an employee represented seat. And then after If enough lives, we set the line at 25,000, wanted to join either of those two boards, then you would add two more seats and capping that at six total, three manager, three employee side, so that we would, you know, hypothetically, 30 years from now, you could get enough local government lives that all of a sudden it's the board's dominated by local government folks. So we want to make sure there was a cap. This is why the amendments are not done yet, because my plan's a little complicated. So that's right. That's what we're working on right now. The other amendment was that what the decision whether to join wouldn't be a mandatory subject of bargaining, so that the local government could have the ability to join. And that was working with Multnomah County, one of their issues they highlighted in the bill. So But that's pretty much where we're going with. You have the list in front of you, and hopefully the amendments will come out soon.
Mr. Towers, then we'll get questions when we have the three.
Chair Greenlee, for members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers. I'm the political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. We represent, in addition to about 24,000 workers covered by PEB currently, we also represent about 3,000 local government workers spread out throughout the state in many small bargaining units, but also right here in Marion County. And we simply wanted to register our support for the direction of this legislation, pending the amendments. Want to take a look at those, but I feel like this is very much on the right track. Thank you very much.
Great. President Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill actually caught my eye early on. I ran and caught Representative Thompson and Greenlee really fast just to find out what was going on with it, because this committee and here was listening to school districts who wanted out of OWEB because, well, small community that I live in that only has 100 employees could save $100,000 by opting out of OWEB. So I'm a little worried if we do this, are we going to look at going mandatory with this later on to make cities and counties get in? Because my small cities can't afford this at all. And I haven't had one city or county come to me asking to be in OWEB. Everybody's asking to get out.
Chair Greenlee, who represent Widener, no, we're not going to change it in the future to be mandatory. And it does have an option if they want to leave. If they've gone in and they are not satisfied, they have the option to go into the health exchange. For I'm on the health exchange, so I have a little familiarity with that, too. For the first year, actually, some of those employers under 50 would have an option to go to the health exchange. Then the next year after that, the employers under 100 could choose to go in the health exchange. They would have the option of OEB, PEB, or the health exchange. And we're not attempting to change that option.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would you be open to an amendment to allow school districts to opt out?
That's not a subject of this bill.
Well, I have an amendment to this bill. I mean, if they're going to allow an opt-in and opt-out for cities and counties, why don't we open it up for the school districts? It's just one more word.
I thought that would be prepare the amendment, and we'll consider it here.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have, I think, four more, so why don't we take two pairs, Travis Graves and Winkles? And then two more.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlee and members of the committee. My name is Travis Graves. I am the Human Resources Director for Multnomah County. I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to say a couple words in support of this bill. Like other large employers, we are experiencing, well, we actually care about the health of our workforce, and we are experiencing cost increases that we worry about the sustainability of our benefit plans. One of the things that we know we can do is consider looking at a larger risk pool. This bill would give our board an opportunity to consider that by joining either the PEB or OEB, and therefore put us into a larger risk pool. And for that reason, I'm here to voice my support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I am the human resources lobbyist for the League of Oregon Cities. I was very pleased to hear the testimony of the earlier panel indicating there are amendments inbound that will clarify that the original intent of the bill is to allow this to be optional. The League supports the right of our members to choose their own destiny in this and all other matters, and we support them having the option to buy into these plans. We as originally drafted, the language caused some consternation and concern among local government advocates. It was unclear that it was mandatory, but again, we would look forward to reviewing the amendments, and hopefully those will clarify our concerns.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for testifying. And I'm curious for Multnomah County.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you've worked very hard to offer transgender health services in a way that has not been offered in a lot of other places. I think the city of Portland and a few other places around the country have done that. Mm-hmm. So if you opted into this, this would be something that you would be negotiating? If you, this would give you the option, you wouldn't have to go into it, but I'm just curious about, has there been any discussion around that issue that OEB or PEB may not offer certain things that you, as self-insured, have?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geyer, that is not something we have looked at yet. I mean, it's very true. We added transgender benefits to both of our benefit plans, kind of one of the first. And we haven't done our due diligence, I would say, to even get that far into looking at what PEB or OEB offers, too. It looks like it's something that we are interested in exploring, though.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Can I call Sina Squires and Frank Stratton, please?
Just in case you're falling asleep on the front.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to appear before you today. My name is Hesina Squires, and I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. With me today is Frank Stratton, the Executive Director of the Association. Our association represents approximately 950 special districts that operate throughout the state. We provide services like water, sewer, fire, irrigation, parks and recreation. We do our membership consists of mainly small, rural types of districts. Half of our members have five or fewer FTEs, and about 40% of our association members have budgets of $100,000 or smaller. In 1987, we did start a small sponsoring, so our association doesn't actually run the program, sponsoring a group association health plan, and that was largely due to the fact that our members were having a difficult time finding health insurance coverage, so we started that as a member benefit for the association. Of the 950 districts that we represent, only 210 of them participate in that program. We have not heard any concerns or concerns other than health costs keep going up. We feel like we provide reasonable health insurance coverage for our members that do participate in our program. In fact, the rural fire protection districts that belong to our program for the last two years have not seen a rate increase. So we have studied, and we do provide options and do look into other potential vendors and other ways to structure our health insurance program, and we have just not found something that would provide our members with a reduced rate. So we did take a very strong look at PEB in the past, and we just found that it was just going to be too expensive for our members to purchase. So maybe an additional look at OEB or PEB in a voluntary manner is something we'd absolutely not object to. Want to provide as many options as possible, but want to make sure that our members are able to afford those options. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, sir.
Just here to answer questions.
I suppose you introduce yourself anyway.
Frank Stratton. I'm the Executive Director of the Special Districts Association, Oregon.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I was going to give it to the other panel, but I'll save it for you two. With the opt-out provision, would you be okay with that, or do you worry about it becoming mandatory later on, because then it's just a couple tweaks of words for us? And the opt-out is only an opt-out to the exchange, not to where you can get private insurance. So would you want a true opt-out or an opt-out that forces you just into another government plan?
Well, our objective is to provide the most options to our members. So if that means opting out to the exchange or to other options that are still available legally on the private market, that would be what we'd prefer. And we don't feel it should be mandatory, so we are concerned that possibly something could be amended later to make it mandatory. Just because, as Hesina said, most of our members have budgets, or half of them almost have budgets under $100,000. So they can't afford a rich plan, and traditionally the plans provided by PEB and OEB are fairly rich, more than our members can afford.
Yes.
Hi, thank you for clarification. Are you hoping that your small group plan will possibly go into OEB or PEB, or are you just saying that the small districts can have a chance to either join your plan or one of theirs? And if they do join theirs as opposed to yours, are you worried about your risk pool getting smaller and costs going up?
Yes, we would consider that they should have an option to look at PEB and OEB as an option. And if that means that our plan ends up shrinking and going away over time, then that's the way it will work out. But we do think that it's a good idea to give them all the options possible.
And could you possibly do that as a group, your entire small group insurance?
It's possible. About 9 years ago, we actually went and talked to PEB. And we're willing to share all of our numbers with them to see if there was a possibility. We didn't go into a really in-depth study, but the preliminary rates and plan designs that were shared back and forth at that time were extremely expensive compared to the group plan that we were already under, but sure, that would be something we could look at.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2279. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2522. We're doing pretty well, it looks like. Time. Oh, let's start with Fern Sable, which I can read. And we have Leo Cyclebaum. Rogan's Bauman, is that right? And after that, we'll have Dan Roth.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee.
Hold on one moment. Yeah, please tell us about it.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm getting better at remembering.
House Bill 2522 requires coordinated care organizations to provide members with access to chiropractic, naturopathic, and nurse practitioner services for primary care and access to licensed acupuncturists, licensed massage therapists, and licensed optometrists for specialty care, and to pay the same reimbursement rate for service for all providers of service, regardless of license or certification of the provider. It requires CCOs and prepaid managed care health service organizations to ensure adequacy of provider network and modifies the description of network adequacy and declares an emergency effective on its passage.
And Vern, you're marked in favor. The other three are marked in opposition. So why don't you start, and then we'll bring the other three up as a panel.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, for the record, Dr. Vern Sable. I'm a chiropractic physician representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. This proposed legislation, House Bill 2522, clarifies already what is in statute. The three issues that it clarifies are the reality that chiropractic and naturopathic physicians and nurse practitioners must be allowed to act in the capacity of primary care providers. If the CCOs cannot discriminate against those provider types if they're in the network as participating providers. I've included a legislative council opinion that speaks to that issue. The foundational non-discrimination language that's based on came from the Accountable Care Act, Section 2706, and the governor lifted that, inserted it in his bill last session, 1580, which was Section 8, and then subsequently became Section 4 and Senate Bill 1509. The three issues, again, that we want to put and clarify is, first of all, the primary care provider issue, which I just discussed, and then varying reimbursement rates cannot be based solely on licensure or certification or discipline, but they are based on quality and performance measures only. Legislative Council speaks to that interpretation, in this case, Lori Freeman. Network adequacy, what constitutes an adequate network of healthcare providers of different professions within the CCO? What's an adequate number? We attempted to define that in administrative rule. It was not accepted. We simply are asking for a definition that's fairly broad, simply states that you have to have adequate numbers of each healthcare profession where possible, to the degree that there are no undue waiting periods or other restrictions for CCO member patients enrollees to see that healthcare provider. again, I've included the that original language. So what we're, in conclusion, all in my testimony, what we would say, if we're going to foundationally change how we deliver health care, not just how we pay for it, there needs to be implementation of all provider types that can provide new interventions that are evidence-based, that provide the kind of outcomes and cost savings that we want to achieve in this new system. Completes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much for that.
Just appreciate your support. Nice to have you here. And I think we need to figure out how to make sure these organizations are inclusive. If I could, just a short testimonial. It's interesting. I had a knee problem recently, and I went to a physical therapist and to a physician, did not receive relief, and two acupuncture treatments, and I'm pain-free. I just think different things work for different folks and maybe at different times. So I think we're going to be comprehensive. We have to be that way.
Yes. Thank you very much. I call Leo Seitrenbaum. Is that anything like right? Anybody here at all? Okay.
I believe
he left. Bruce Rogans Bowman, is it? Is that Bowman?
Bowman.
Mm-hmm. And Dan Roth?
Thank you, Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee. I'm Ruth Rogers Bauman. I'm the chair of the board for Willamette Valley Community Health, the CCO here in Salem. I'd like to offer a couple of points for your consideration. First, we think that a bill of this nature, and to some degree, undermines the original CCO legislation. That legislation calls for the community advisory groups to conduct an assessment, a needs assessment in the community, and we think that's an excellent way to determine what resources are needed and how to integrate those. And so we would like to allow that process to play its role and look at issues of this sort. In regard to the payment requirements that are included in this bill, one of our concerns is that it continues to focus on fee-for-service type payments rather than other kinds of payments. It ignores the fact that stakeholders in the CCOs, particularly in the provider community, are risk takers, and it does not seem to conclude that idea for this group of providers. And lastly, I'd like to point out that we ask the CCOs to be innovative and to develop new ways of doing that. They need to have the latitude, especially at this point in the early part of their beginning, to determine how to do that. And the more flexibility they have to do that, I think the better the outcome will be, and the better able they'll be able to meet the needs of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hi. My name is Daniel Roth. I am a medical doctor. I am currently, for the last 16 months, employed as one of the medical directors for Family Care, a CCO in Portland. And prior to that, I worked for 20 years for Kaiser here in Salem as an internist and as a hospitalist, starting the first hospitalist program here at Salem Hospital. And for the last 10 years, as the medical director for primary care here in Salem for Kaiser. In my 25 years of hospital and administrative experience, I think House Bill 2522 is dangerous. The notion of allowing naturopaths and chiropractors to be considered primary care physicians is just not acceptable. The depth and breadth of their training does not meet the needs of a growing elderly population and the complexity that we see in healthcare. As our population gets older, we see more chronic conditions, congestive heart failure, diabetes, depression, congestive heart failure, end organ disease related to diabetes, like renal manifestations. It is not within the scope and the skill of a chiropractor to be managing that, and I would argue, or a naturopath. I do, as Representative Kimmerer talked about, having acupuncturists. We do support the notion of having acupuncturists, naturopaths, chiropractors within the CCOs practicing as complementary medicine or complementary providers within the CCOs, but not, and let me emphasize, not as primary care providers with the complexity of the medical illnesses that we're dealing with. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Well, I tend to agree with with your last statement, but I'm going to channel Representative Thompson for a moment here. Do you have a sense that we can handle all the demand for primary care that's coming on board and the current way we organize, especially with the notion of another perhaps 250,000 people having access to the Oregon Health Plan and therefore the CCOs? So, did I say that right?
Yeah, I think so.
That's
a concern for us. It is a concern, and that's one of the reasons why we increased our reimbursement to primary care providers to gain access for these patients. It is a distress sell. They are a challenging population. But I would argue in the Oregon Health Plan, where you have a disproportionate number of pregnant women and children, that their needs are not going to be safely met by chiropractors and naturopaths. I think we need to be able to financially incentivize primary care physicians and nurse practitioners to manage these patients more in a traditional model with the support of naturopaths, chiropractors, acupuncturists as a supporting role.
Representative Thompson.
I don't think there's anything in this bill that allows any of those practitioners to exceed their present scope of practice.
It refers to them as primary care providers. And one would assume that they would then have a panel of patients that they would be responsible for in the CCOs.
Within the scope of their practice.
Within the scope of their practice. But I think what we're doing is that does not necessarily add value to the CCO or to the member. They're still going to need a pediatrician or a family medicine doctor. To consider them as the principal primary care provider is inappropriate. I have no problem with them being a supporting clinician in the care of that member, but not as the primary care provider.
I think there's some argument on the definition that
yeah,
they have to have for a different
that.
Day as
yeah.
to what a primary care
right.
physician. And
yeah.
I think I've heard Dr. Sable say, although I hear notion of dealing with colorectal cancer and other things that makes me a little nervous, but that there are things that chiropractors do that could qualify as a primary care service that they would like to get paid for, not that they would like to become the primary care physician. He's nodding back. So I think we have some discussion about that. But
okay.
I, too, get nervous about that. Can I ask Cindy Roberts to join us?
Sure, you just made my point. So
oh, okay. Good. All right, well, thank you. Ooh, I'm sorry. Yes, go ahead.
I can't
believe this. We're actually done.
Wow. What we're looking for, I believe, is balance. On the flip side, if we don't have something like this, don't we run the risk of excluding all practice types except MDs?
No, we don't currently. We have nurse practitioners that have very large practices within our panels. We have physician's assistants that are tied to a medical physician's license practicing to take care of our patients. They are appropriate primary care providers. Internists, family medicine providers, pediatricians, nurse practitioners, PAs. Chiropractors, naturopaths, acupuncturists are not appropriate primary care providers.
If I could add a comment, Representative Thompson, Medicare already has non-discrimination rules that are in place that would assure that people are able to participate in that. And as Dr. Roth mentioned, it's not an issue about can they participate in some way, it's an issue of what role do they play.
We are looking at financially incentivizing primary care more money than specialists so that they have access to get in to see these providers. This would require that we pay everyone the same. And again, I also think that that's not appropriate.
I'd like to comment on Bauman's point also that I think we really have to get away from the focus on fee-for-service payments and to try and, as we create primary care homes, pay the providers in a completely different model,
right.
But that doesn't change this. Yes, Representative Kennemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just want to respond to the comment about not qualified providers. I guess in my view that's in the eye of the beholder, and that is a traditional medical perspective, and within some limits, one that I happen to somewhat agree with. I don't see a natural path for primary care. But I know that there are a lot of people who do. And in fact, they're very uncomfortable seeing a traditional MD or other medical person. So I think if we're going to be comprehensive and reach all the public and meet needs, I think it's a dangerous thing to say they're unqualified. I think their qualifications are different, and hopefully they work within the scope of practice in which they are competent, and that has as its primary goal the same one that you have, the best interest of the patient.
I guess I would push back on that in the sense of when one looks at the metrics like Dr. Goldberg presented earlier that the CCOs are being held accountable to, I don't think you could identify chiropractors or naturopathic doctors to be able to fulfill those requirements effectively, the outcomes of those results effectively within the scope of their training.
And I guess I'm not familiar enough with it to be able to make the counter-argument if there is one.
Okay. I can tell you that we've given naturopaths a very big pharmacopoeia.
So yes. Yeah. Yes, we have.
Captain Widener.
Oh, I think this will be back, possibly, and we can deal with it then. But, I mean, I think we need to be careful on tying the CCO's hands, and I think each one's going to have to treat their respective district or area a little differently depending upon what they're dealing with in patients and telling them what they can and can't provide. I mean, they have limited resources and they're going to have to function with the resources that they have, and if they can't afford to keep chiropractic or naturopath in their plan, then I don't think we should be forcing them to do it and let them have the flexibility that they need. It's kind of where I'm at. So.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate that. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill, where are we? 2522. And we got them all in today. Thank you, committee members, for your parsimony and your patience. We are adjourned early.